Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, your sorry so-and-sos, you got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum, government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you dat dumb government?
Well, good evening and welcome to Handling the Truth with Terry Dodd and Mike Getty. Hello, Mike. How you doing, buddy?
Doing absolutely fantastic.
Well, hey, we are certainly blessed tonight because we got Dave Scorpio joining us. And Dave, you want to say hello?
Okay. Hello, Terry and Mike. Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to hearing about what Mike is so excited about.
Me too, but before we do that, I better open this thing with a prayer because we always get into trouble when we don't do that. We'll have technical difficulties and all sorts of craziness if we don't start it out right. So I'm going to open us with a prayer. Almighty Father, Creator, only self-existent one in the whole universe, we know that it's you that sustains us and only you that can sustain us eternally. We just thankful for the fact that you find us to be significant, that you provide for us a way to come back to you and cover our unrighteousness with your Son's righteousness. We invite your Spirit to be with us tonight. Bring this message forward in truth, and we just pray our listeners we'll grasp this tonight and have open minds to what we're about to tell. And we pray that everything we do here pleases you and is in your desire. Thank you for bringing Dave on with us tonight. Thank you for keeping Mike and I healthy and able to continue to bring this truth forward. We know that there's a lot of forces out there that would want this truth shut down. And we pray for your protection against that. It's in the name of your Son, our Savior, our King, Yahshua HaMashiach, we pray. Amen. Well, Mike, this is really an exciting discovery you've made. I'm still a little curious as to, you know, what the purpose of this coming before you is, because it's certainly an interesting discovery, and I'm just going to let you tell our listeners about it.
Well, Terry, as you and Dave both know, I have been researching and studying on the founding era of America and our misnamed Civil War for several decades now. And so this just kind of took me to a different place. I was last Sunday, as Dave will well remember, we did a show on the founding era and the Constitution and the things that I have begun to uncover in this decades-long search. And ironically, I did that, and then sometime this week, early part of the week, I started looking at some different aspects. And one of the subjects that I always hated in school and I never did care for, and that was economics. And it was just, to me, everything about it was so dull and so boring. I didn't want anything to do with it. And so I usually will avoid economics, and much to my own loss, I promise you. But anyway, I found this book. I saw that it was written by a northern economist, and it was published in the year 1860. And I was actually looking at this as moving towards some of the for some background on the program that we'll have on my show on Revolution Radio on Sunday night, where we'll be talking about was slavery the was the cause of the Civil War. And I was doing this research, and I found this book, again, by an economist, published in 1860. So it's, you know, 160 years old, folks. And he goes into just absolute finite detail, and he pulls some more layers off this onion that I had never even considered. And the title of the book is Southern Wealth and Northern Profits as Exhibited in Statistical Facts and Official Figures. Well, as soon as I saw that statistical facts and official figures, I had to look at this thing. And then it says the statistical facts and official figures showing the necessity of union to the future prosperity and welfare of the Republic by Thomas Prentice Cattell, or Kettle, I'm not exactly sure how he pronounced it, but it says he was the late editor of the Democratic Review in New York by George W. and John A. Wood, Law Building, 62 Nassau Street in 1860. Well, I got into this, and then I think we need to lay a little background, and here is the thing that we did, and Dave, I hope I don't hit you with too much redundancy here, but last Sunday evening we hit on this, and that being that there was no mention of slavery in the Articles of Confederation. Absolutely none. It's not referenced, it's not mentioned, or anything. And so then along comes the Federalists pushing for a new Constitution starting in about 1782 to 83. They start saying they need to get out from under the limits of the Articles of Confederation. And then by the time the war is over in 1785, actually it was over in 1783, and they kind of, Robert Morris and Gouverneur Morris drug it out for two more years to squeeze all of the tax money they could out of the program. And so the actual peace treaty was signed in 1785. Well, almost immediately the Federalists start pushing for a new Constitution. And they cite, of course, the terrible drain that's on the government, that the government is out of money and people don't have a lot of money after a war. And, you know, there's not a lot of industry going and the trade with England is shut off. And so everything is in kind of a troubled period. So they believe that starting a new constitution, or getting a new constitution, even though it was a trick because they were sent there to amend the Articles of Confederation, and they had no intention of ever doing that. The Federalists went there fully with the idea, and you can tell that from the letters between them prior to going to Philadelphia, letters especially between James Madison and George Washington, James Madison, Edmund Randolph, Alexander Hamilton, other various people, that there was no intention of amending the Articles. They were going to come up with a complete new document. So, A, we know there was nothing mentioned about slavery in the Articles of Confederation. And we know there were slaves. We know there were slaves in the colonies at that time, and they had been brought there by King George. We also know that in the Constitution of 1787, as it was drawn up and as it was debated, the Constitution of 1787 codified slavery. It embraced slavery and brought slavery into the government. So the question in my mind was, why? Why would suddenly, in a government that didn't even acknowledge slavery, why would suddenly they have to have a government that embraced it? And not only embraced it, but guaranteed its continuance for 20 more years. And you couple that with the fact that these same Federalists said no to a Bill of Rights when it was proposed by Gary and Mason at the end in September of 1787. They proposed a Bill of Rights, and they were shut down, and it was no, we're not going to do a Bill of Rights. So it's, you know, it's suspicious. If you have an inquisitive mind and you're honest with your thoughts and you go, okay, we had a constitution with no slavery. We end up with a constitution with slavery embraced for 20 years and no Bill of Rights. And of course they tried, the Federalists tried to slip it by on the people, but the Anti-Federalists were too sharp for them, because when they were asked, well, what about a Bill of Rights? And they said, well, you have a state Bill of Rights. You know, all of your states have a Bill of Rights, so you don't have to worry about a Bill of Rights. And then, of course, Luther Martin says, no, wait a minute. The Supremacy Clause, Article 6, Clause 2, basically says that the federal government can overrule any of the states and their Bill of Rights at any time. So, no, we do not have the protection of our own Bill of Rights. So, you know, I thought it was it would be interesting to also jump back like we did on Sunday. And again, Dave, pardon me for being redundant, but we went to Thomas Jefferson and the paragraph that was excluded from the Declaration of Independence. And I think this is most germane to the issue. When Thomas Jefferson included a passage attacking slavery in his draft of the Declaration of Independence, it initiated the most intense debate among the delegates gathered at Philadelphia in the spring and early summer of 1776. Well, why were they debating over slavery? Why was that an issue with the Declaration of Independence? Jefferson's passage on slavery was the most important section removed from the final document. It was replaced with a more ambiguous passage about King George's incitement of domestic insurrections among us. Decades after this, I think it was certainly before his death, I think it was in the 1820s, Jefferson blamed the removal of the passage on delegates from South Carolina and Georgia and northern delegates who represented merchants who were at the time actively involved in the transatlantic slave trade. Now, this is going to become even more important as we move into this new book on economics. But Jefferson's original passage on slavery is this, and I think it's worth reading. And, quote, he has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian King of Great Britain, determined to bring open a market where men should be bought and sold. He has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or restrain this execrable commerce. And that this assemblage of horrors might want no fact of distinguished die, he is now exciting these very people to rise in arms among us and to pursue that liberty of which he has deprived them by murdering the people on whom he has obtruded them, thus paying off former crimes committed against the liberty of one people with crimes which he urges them to commit against the lives of another. Well, so Jefferson wants to condemn slavery in the Declaration of Independence, 1776. Two factions who would profit financially by continuing slavery did not want that included in the Declaration of Independence. And that was, he says, of South Carolina and Georgia and the northern shipping industry. Well, when you get into this book, Terry, that I've sent you a copy of, and I will send Dave a PDF on this book, is that why suddenly did we have this real issue? Because in this book, it says that after the war was over, there were over 600,000 slaves in America. But the financial circumstances and the financial conditions in the country, all 13 colonies, was to the point that the people who owned these slaves could not afford to keep them. They couldn't feed them. They couldn't house them. They couldn't provide them and their own families with subsistence. And so there was a large move, and you won't find this in your high school history book, I promise you. There was a large move, and this is documented in 1860. There was a large move to emancipate the slaves after the Revolutionary War was over, because the people who owned them said, hey, there's no money coming in. We have no crops. There's nothing we can do right now. There's nothing to justify this. Think back about, and, you know, we're going to jump to cotton at some point, but cotton was not that important back then. And even when cotton became important, before the cotton gin was invented by Eli Whitney, it was non-productive to try to produce cotton, to put the cotton together, because one person working all day long would produce a pound of cotton. So it was not a feasible enterprise. So here we were going to release these people, as it should have been done, which was what Jefferson was pushing for as well. The people were going to be allowed to step out of bondage and be freed. But then suddenly, 2 years later, we have a constitution which not only embraces slavery and codifies it into government, but extends it for 20 years. Now, to the common, ordinary, everyday thinking person, what could that mean, Terry?
I can think of a number of things. It obviously something changed. Somebody had some influence. It means that they saw slavery as another way of making money, because, and I'm talking about those in Philadelphia. These are all mostly people from the North that were doing this, and they obviously shifted to thinking on slavery because they didn't want to wipe out their industry. But we know now that this criminal conspiracy was significantly about taxation and being able to bring the war bonds that they had picked up for pennies on the dollar. We know that they put those at face value and made an obligation for them to be paid. So you would have to suspect that this move on slavery was similar to that.
Well, I will quote from the book. Well, thank you. I agree. And quoting from the book, it says, at the close of the War of Independence, the country was composed of exhausted colonies, having a population of 3,172,464 whites. The government was heavily in debt and without credit. The channels of trade flooded with irredeemable and depreciated paper that had driven away specie. National bankruptcy and individual insolvency were the rule. People were destitute of capital and manufactures. The employment of the shipping apparently destroyed, and the future presenting very little hope. There were 751,363 black slaves who were here without employment that would earn their own support, and their fate of that of their masters gave ample cause of uneasiness as well to statesmen as to the owners. To abandon the blacks to their fate under the plea of philanthropy suggested itself to many. The employment of northern ships was mostly the slave trade, while the South, having daily less employment for the blacks, was determined to stop the trade, to stop the arrival of new slaves, a measure which the North regarded as depriving it of its legitimate business. Thus, growing jealousy was added to other evils. So here, written in 1860, and a guy with no axe to grind one way or the other, because obviously the war had not occurred yet, and he was looking at it strictly economically, so he had no reason to distort history. So as he was saying, the people could not afford to keep these people in bondage because they couldn't afford to keep them up and their families. So what is the alternative? You free the people, And it had begun to happen in the northern states as well, because as we mentioned last Sunday, the Supreme Court of the state of Massachusetts outlawed slavery in 1780, 7 years before the Constitutional Convention, 1781, I'm sorry, 6 years before the Constitutional Convention. It was outlawed with the Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, William Cushing, stating in his decision that if we take literally the Declaration of Independence, all men are created free and equal, then slavery, by its very definition, is unconstitutional, and they outlawed slavery. Several other states followed them. So with a movement to abolish slavery, the only thing that kept slavery going was the Constitution of 1787. And I know that's a bitter pill for a lot of people to swallow, but it's factual. The only thing that kept slavery going was that Constitutional Convention in 1787, where they embraced slavery, codified it into the government, and came up with that spurious three-fifths clause, which actually saved by the South, believe it or not, because the North had said they didn't want the slaves to count for anything, because it would be used in representation, and therefore they were afraid that the South would be able to outvote them in the Congress. So they would have more representatives because they're counting the blacks as people. So they compromised on the three-fifths clause. The South catches the dickens over that three-fifths clause, but if it hadn't have been, Elbridge Gerry, of all people, said, well, if those people in the South get to count their slaves, I get to count my horses, chickens, and pigs. That's actually in the transcripts. So, we want to blame the South with all this. We want to tear down all these monuments to these crazy Southerners, and we want to destroy the South. It comes from an ignorance of history. Anything you got now, Terry?
No. Keep going. Dave, you might want to have Dave jump in here. This is definitely different than anything I ever heard out of a textbook. So.
Well, Mike, I can see why you're so fired up about this, because what I'm getting from what you've said so far is that one of the primary aspects of the narrative of the Civil War is being completely turned upside down by this book.
Well, it does. It turns it upside down, and I realize there's some comments in this book that are obviously today would be taken as racist. But and he said in 1860 he could not believe that the industrial North would be willing to destroy themselves financially, freeing the black race. And another point that was made, and of course, that's, again, you're talking about money taking place. Oh, but I think that's the exact issue we're dealing here with. Because the only reason for the Constitution of 1787 to embrace slavery was money. There is no other reason whatsoever. Because if you codify it into the government and you make it and you stipulate that it is to be observed until 1808, of course, this is 1787. So why? What other reason, if you're a delegate and you go to Philadelphia, why else would you even consider slavery if it wasn't about money?
Yeah, it wasn't exactly an egalitarian enterprise on either side. And, I've never heard the figure stated that you did that the average slave picked about 1 pound of cotton per day. I've never heard that statistic before, and it really sort of drives home how unprofitable the enterprise was becoming.
Well, the book says that it took one person to produce a pound of cotton. I guess that's taking it out of the, doing all the process and actually not picking it so much as actually taking it out of the whatever they call that cotton husk or whatever it is. I'm not very familiar with that, but you had to remove it. You had to take it out. It had to be picked out. And by doing it by hand, each person produced a pound of cotton a day. Well, as soon as the cotton gin is invented, that jumps to 360 pounds a day. So you can see, and that is the statistics listed here in this book.
Yeah,
so
very interesting.
Dave, I'm looking forward to you getting into this book because there's, I mean, the things that, that Mike's touching on right now are just the tip of the iceberg of what's in this book. The initial description of capital is significant in and of itself without any of the rest of these things because it shows the philosophy of the banksters. Exposes the fact that they recognized this thing of being able to live off of the sweat of another man's brow. The wealth that was established was because they were able to have excess production. That in essence is what capital is defined as, and it shows this basic philosophy and shows where the necessity of slavery or a large family was necessary prior to this industrial growth of machinery. Mike, would you maybe comment a little bit about that?
Well, he goes into super detail as you move into the middle chapter. He goes into finite detail, and the thing I love about this guy is he produces population figures. I mean, there are charts and tables showing population, showing wealth, showing the increase and everything else. He shows that, and as the title says, these all came from official records. And he not only says where he obtained the records, he shows, what year. And he goes into infinite detail on this. And an example, he shows the change from 1850 to 1858 in the property of the people. In the North, in 1850, their property was worth $3,095,833,338. In 1858, it had risen to $3,426,000,000. And then he shows the wealth of the West, and then he also shows the wealth of the South. And the South had gone in 1850 from $2,947,781,366 to $4,620,617,564 in a short period of 8 years. And he shows it from the census, and he shows that the figures were from the state census of each state. He'd gone into that detail. He says in 1800, the whole valuation for the levy of a federal tax was $619 million. There has then been an increase of property valuation of $6,447 million up to 1850 and of $3,072 million, which would be $3.7 billion, from 1850 to 1858. How strong a contrast does this represent to the condition of affairs in 1790? This immense property has been developed under the harmonious working of the federal constitution, and the country has become the asylum and admiration of the old world from the political contest of which it has remained aloof. So he was showing how that the country prospered, and he was showing how that the country was prospering very much on slavery during that time frame. But prior to that, he shows how for 200 years, and he makes the open statement, that 200 years of slavery built England, that's where the money came from. And he shows with charts, again, he shows the wealth. And it proves beyond, I don't see how anyone who could think logically and I realize there's not a lot of those around. I'm not sure how anyone who can think logically cannot see, and he basically stipulates that the Constitution of 1787 was created to protect the institution of slavery and the northern slave shipping industry, because that was the only thing that was producing any money at that time. And he goes into the trading patterns, where what they were taking and what they were bringing back. He goes into great detail about that. So it's quite interesting to read this. And as I'm sure, no one is going to use this as a college textbook or going to refer to it. And I'm sure, and as I said, I had not heard of it until just recently, that it was actually there. And, you know, maybe I can blame myself for that, but for whatever reason. But it, again, I do not see how anyone can now refute the fact of why we went from an Articles of Confederation that had did not embrace the institution of slavery at any way, shape, form, or fashion, how that could happen. And then we have a constitution created that embraces slavery for at least 20 years.
He also talks about, and in just a little bit that I got into, how the living conditions and lifestyles, clothing, provisions, housing, all of that sort of thing for the slaves went from being basically an impoverished condition back around the time of the Revolutionary War to a much improved, so improved that the conditions of living for these slaves were better prior to the Civil War than it was in their home countries that they were taken from.
Exactly. He goes into quite a bit of detail on that, and I know no one's going to want to hear that except maybe Thomas Sowell, because Thomas Sowell did tell in a debate with Kwasi and Toomey and the Reverend Ralph Abernathy one time, he said that he thanked God for slavery, because if it hadn't been for slavery, he might have been in Africa hunting lions with a sharp stick. So there is a there's a great, and this point is made very well in the book. And if people, this book is for sale at Amazon in paperback for $14. So if you want to check it out and look at it for yourselves, it is available. I double checked that this morning when Terry and I were talking, and I haven't been able to find any hardback versions yet. But it's also available on the internet in a PDF form. So here's something that people should look at, because Terry, thank you for bringing that up, because what he says in 1860, which when he wrote the book, he said that the blacks in the South were in better condition than blacks anywhere else on the planet. Even being in a state of servitude, and we know that's wrong. It's morally wrong. But regardless, you can't go away from the fact of what he stated. And I'm sure that those people in the South did not realize that the people in the other parts of the world were worse off than they were. There was no way to know that. But he documents it very well in that book. So it is I haven't finished reading the book. I'm about five or six chapters in, but there is so much information in this book and so documented and so detailed. I mean, this guy and most economists are that way. I mean, he footnotes everything. Everything he shows what he shows.
Mike, I was wondering if you have the name of this, the author of this book, and any background information you might have on him.
I haven't done any research on him except for the fact of what I read in the beginning. It's Kittle or Cattell, and I will post this on my website on Rebel Madman. I'll post all pertinent information to this, including a link, so where the people who maybe want to download the e-version of this, or if you wanted, you know, a a paperback version. You could order it yourself from Amazon. But it puts everything, another piece of the puzzle together for me, Dave. And it shows, and he says that what happened is that England, and he shows with statistics, everything was flourishing in England under King George, while the people in America were working, and really not increasing their wealth at all. And then he draws what I thought was a wonderful contrast, or a wonderful, picture to illustrate his point. And he says, okay, he said, so I give you a farm, and I'm paraphrasing here, I give you a farm of 200 acres, and I tell you to, I will give you your subsistence to work for me, and every year you will turn the products of that land over to me, and it will be mine. And so for 20 years or 10 years, you work at that, and all you've done is had a subservient living. But you have existed. You've had food. You've had clothes. You've had a roof over your head. And so what you end up with at the end of that term, he has all the wealth. The guy who owns the property has all the wealth, and all you have done was mark time. And you have worn out the land, and you have worn out the equipment that you use to produce. And he then, later in the book, Terry, which I think is just absolutely fantastic, he equates that to basically what happened to the people. He didn't know about after the war at that time, but he equates that to the people becoming subservient economic slaves to the banking industry. And that is exactly what you do, and that's exactly, and when I look at it and parallel it forward to today, that's exactly what we're doing. We have been told we are slaves, economic slaves, to the international bankers, because we slave away on whatever property they let us have. And then we, and we produce, and whatever we produce, they take it, except what we need to survive in most instances. So
and inflation is a hidden tax on labor.
Exactly. So he makes that point so well, and the way that he brings it up, that basically, and then I think one of the things that really struck me is when he said that England and King George, that is the relationship they had with the colonies. And after the Constitution of 87, New England states assume the role of England, and the Southern states assume the role of the colonists. And
I could see him going down the path of his statistics showing, or his statistics illustrate quite clearly the stress or the conflict between the North and the South, because the South was so much more fertile, longer growing season, much more productive agriculturally, even talked about hay being so valuable because, it supported the beef and the cattle that was mostly in the South. And so you had this symbiotic relationship between these credit in the North and the industry of the North versus the agricultural of the South, and them trying to take advantage of that and not being able to allow the South to withdraw that symbiotic relationship with the North, causing a great deal of stress because they could not control them any longer because the South was getting sick and tired of the way they were being treated by the banksters through the credit.
Well, that
didn't you see that clearly in the book?
Absolutely. And one of the other things as you move on, and I think you'll find this point very well taken, is suddenly as the migration began to move westward, the southern states realized the bonanza of growing opportunity for cotton that was to be had in Mississippi and Alabama. because, you know, most people don't know because they aren't taught in school. But Georgia was Georgia, Mississippi, and Alabama, and Mississippi went all the way to the Mississippi River, and that was the state of Georgia. But then there became a big rush for land in Mississippi because it was ideal for growing cotton. This was, you know, this was nirvana for the cotton growers. So you had these people moving into who had been growing cotton in the in Georgia, what is now Georgia and South Carolina, and then they find out about this very fertile land along the Mississippi River in Mississippi and how fantastic it's going to be for raising cotton. So then a lot of the people start moving there, but they need to borrow money to buy land, to buy these large portions of land. Jefferson Davis was one of them. So was the Wade Hampton's family. They were moving west into Mississippi, and they went into debt, went very deep into debt to buy land in Mississippi once that this was discovered, what a great place it was to grow cotton. So imagine, if you will, what did they use for collateral for those debts? Any ventures there, gentlemen?
I'm just going to wait on this one.
This is what really struck me about the book. The people moving west into that property in Mississippi listed their slaves by name and age as collateral on the money to buy that land in Mississippi. And that was something I had never heard before. Had you gentlemen ever heard of that?
I had heard something that alluded to that. Also, he talks about the increase in the value or the valuation on the slaves from time to time.
Right, and that their value increased, and that was one of the reasons they were used for collateral. And then
went from like $200 up to about $1,800 or something, wasn't it?
Right. And then he makes the analogy, and think about what $1,800 was in that time as compared to today. And then he makes the analogy, he takes it into after the Constitution was written and Hamilton gets through his bank. And then he basically says that and stretches it out to the point to where the people become collateral. Think about your Social Security number today. If you have a child that's born, they get a Social Security number. That Social Security number is used as collateral against the national debt. Future income, future to be made, future income from that individual. So I know that there are people going to be upset that actual slaves were used as collateral for a debt, but it's happening today with everybody, both races, all races. Thoughts, gentlemen, while I catch a drink of water here?
Go ahead, Dave. I can see the wheels turning in that head of yours.
Well, Mike, early in your discourse, you alluded to, that the original calls to amend or change the Articles of Confederation was to get out of certain restrictions. Now, are you saying that those people, the restrictions were essentially slavery, or what was the reasons that they were giving publicly for these restrictions?
Well, the thing that they needed, Dave, and the thing that they got, and I think this is critical. Again, I'm going to bring this up, and people are going to say you're going to ring that bell till it doesn't ring anymore. But the point of it is the very first power given to Congress was the power of unlimited taxation from unlimited sources. So they knew they had to keep the South together. They had to keep the states together in 1787. They had to keep the states together. They could not let them leave because if you stop and think about it, it's simple arithmetic. Would you rather have the taxes from 10 people or 200? So again, it was an economic
right.
thing, but they were able to stretch out. They were going to be able to tax everybody. And in the Constitution, they agreed to a $10 per head tax on all slaves that went to the federal government, went to the central government, didn't go to the states, went to the central government. The reason, Dave, it was Article 13 of the Articles of Confederation. They could not get by that. They had tried repeatedly from 1782 to 1787 to try to get by that Article 13. And Article 13 said that for anything to pass, any legislation had to pass, had to be approved by all 13 states. And they had tried various schemes, and they referred to it as schemes. Maybe it meant something to them different, but to me it was a scheme. And they referred to their schemes being thwarted by one state. In the Mount Vernon meeting in 1785, that was our best efforts can be thrown aside by just the vote of one state. And so they felt like they had to get away from that. So there was no way that they were going
right.
to...
Right, so-called majority them. Rule, yeah.
Right, they had to go, they could not go, they had to escape consent of the governed. And consent of the governed means if we're going to be governed, you, Terry, and I, it has to have all three of our consent. Because if one of us says yes and two say no, Or two say yes, one say no, someone is operating without their consent. So the articles were drawn up specifically to align with the Declaration of Independence. And I had a class several years ago. I taught in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and I brought this up, and some guy who was a retired government employee stood up and he says, "Well, that doesn't make sense," he said, "because if every state had to agree, the government would never get anything done." And I said, hallelujah. Because how can you say, you know, we go to what Jefferson referred to with democracy as mob rule. If the majority can tell the minority what's going to happen to them, regardless, it's not always going to be good. I promise you. So Article 13, I hope I answered that question, Dave. That's what the Federalists had to get away from. They could not allow one state, and this happened on two separate occasions, where they thought they were slipping through a tax that would get all of those guys who were holding this needed to be paid, especially Robert Morris, Gouverneur Morris, James Wilson, several of these other people who were involved in that fiasco that Samuel Bryan illustrated in Sentinel, the fraud of where Morris comes out with $17 million. Morris wanted to be paid. These other people wanted to be paid their money. There was no guarantee for them to be paid unless they could put it on the people, unless they could put the people to pay the taxes. That was their only chance to recover their money. And they were willing. They went to the Constitutional Convention in 1787 and wrote a constitution that would allow them to collect the money to pay them, the money that they had.
Okay, so that was the bone of contention. I get it. The so-called majority rule versus consent of the governed. And that's such an important distinction that's hardly ever discussed. It's so significant, though.
Well, and Mike, maybe you can elaborate on that particular point, because – doesn't Cattell get into specifically this issue of experiment of self-governance? And what is he really talking about in this peace and harmony situation? Is that really – it sounds like a good thing, but I got a feeling that that's really not a good thing, because it requires that peace and harmony to exist in order for them to continue – to steal the production of the people. And you also mentioned about the question, and you kind of skimmed over it, where the relationship, the parallel in the relationship between England and the colonies shifted after the Constitution, to a relationship, similar parallel relationship with the North and the South. And I think today that relationship has shifted to the deep state and the general public. Can you,
well,
he gets into that, doesn't he?
He does. He goes into quite a bit on that subject. And I think he was exactly right, because stop and think about it, gentlemen, the people at the Constitutional Convention who call themselves Federalists were not Federalists. They assumed that name as a mode of deception. They were nationalist at best, monarchist at most. And stop and think about what they said. James Wilson, Robert Morris, Alexander Hamilton. They spoke about how wonderful the government of England was. They were cognizant of what England had done to the colonies, and they wanted to be independent so they could do the same thing that England had been doing. And Mr. Cattell gets right to that, and that's what he says. Once the Constitution was ratified, the New England states became King George III, and the South became the colonies. Finally, it kept manifesting itself over and over and over again. And the statistics go to the point that 82-83% of the total revenue for the entire country was coming from the South in 1860. So there was no way that Lincoln could let those Southern states go, and the industry in the North was not going to let that happen. They couldn't let that happen because those, and later in this book, it goes into how the textile mills in the North, especially in Massachusetts, there were towns that just sprung up in Massachusetts for nothing but textile mills. And where did the cotton come from? So when the Southern states said, when they increased the tax again with the Marl tariff, which happened before Lincoln took office, but the Marl tariff had been approved, and it was going to tax the Southern production at something like 40%. And the South said, we can't live with that. And then not only, Cattell goes into this as well, is that the revenues that were taken in for the government were primarily being spent to improve the North. And he goes into some detail, citing official records, that this money that was coming in, the revenue, was being employed in the northern states for improvements. You know, whatever improvements they were having were being done, you know, whether it's roads or streets or, you know, whatever you're doing that the government is doing, the majority of that money was spent in the North. So the people in the South were becoming, as he alluded to, the people in the South, the Southern states, were becoming the colonies. And again, New England was King George.
Yeah, that's such a great analogy. And, you know, it's representative of how there's always been this struggle between, you know, the people that produce the raw materials and then the capitalists and the manufacturers above them. And it's just, you know, a struggle that's been going on since the dawn of time, I think.
Oh, that's
and
true.
That's
and there
why
were...
the St. Andrew's cross is on that flag.
Well, very well said, Terry. And then again, you know, most people don't realize that that flag was the Union Jack. Not the Union Jack, I'm sorry, but that was the naval flag of the Confederacy. And it was not the battle flag of the Confederacy, was not adopted as the battle flag of the Confederacy until 1863, just right before Gettysburg. So the actual
Terry,
flag,
could you expound upon your comment about the flag?
The St. Andrew's Cross had a history of resistance to tyranny. And that's why that flag had the St. Andrew's cross on it, because it was all about resisting tyranny. It was never about racism or slavery or any of that. It was about resistance to this tyranny that was going on. And can I just jump out of this for a second, and I'm going to sound like I'm changing the subject, but I'm really not.
Whatever blows your dress
what
up, Terry.
Was,
have at it.
What was Barack Obama's grandmother's business?
Well, I try not
to. She was a banker,
say,
right?
She went from being a bank teller to being an executive vice president of the bank 3 months. How did she do that? You obviously don't know how she did that. She did that by doing microfinance. You ever heard of microfinance? Do you know what microfinance is?
Micro and macro. Go ahead.
It's where the deep pockets, the central banksters, go out and lend money to agricultural land all over the globe, knowing full well that that much of that money will never be paid back and they'll have to take the land instead. And that's what Barack Obama's grandmother did and was good at, and what moved her from being a teller to the vice president of the bank in 3 months. And when she retired and died, Barack Obama's mother went into the microfinance business, working for the banksters. What I'm telling you is that this game that Cattell is bringing out here and showing in detail, we're still dealing with it today significantly.
Well, I can't do anything but agree
yeah,
with
absolutely.
You. Yeah,
absolutely.
Sorry, Dave.
No, I was just saying, absolutely, I agree. Absolutely. Good, very good point.
There are so many analogies that can be drawn to present day in these studies as you look at this and you see how these things are going, Terry. And I'm glad you were able to pick some of those out for yourself. And as you move on into this book, you're going to find even more.
It just fills in the it's so much confirms my big picture puzzle picture. You know I refer to that big picture puzzle or big puzzle picture a lot because it's kind of the backbone of my discernment of data or information, and this fits in with it so perfectly. It just makes it beyond probability, if you understand what I mean.
I certainly do. And I think
so. Talk to us a little more about this parallel, because I want to know more about if he draws this parallel between England and the colonies and the North and the South. I think that's really important.
Well, basically, as he mentions, England was getting fat off the colonies because the produce that was being produced in the colonies was being sent to England. That was their main trade, and that's why it was such a catastrophe after the war was over, because Britain said, England, King George said, we're not going to trade with you anymore. So the shipping had nothing to ship and nowhere to ship it to.
And the capital flow stopped.
Right. And because of that, that is when that the people who owned slaves said, we can't afford this. We can't afford to keep these people up. I mean, just stop and think today, if you had a job, well, there's lots of people that's happened again with this pandemic. You could basically consider if you were a business owner, if you owned, let's say, a movie theater. And we all know that the majority of profit for a movie theater comes from the sale of concessions. But let's say you had, well, what would have happened when they came up with this pandemic thing if they said, okay, you know, you're not going to be able to make any more money in your movie theater. You're not going to be able to make any at all, but you still have to pay these people who worked for you. You have to pay them and so that they can maintain their lifestyle. You have to continue to pay them even though you have no money coming in. Well, that was basically what happened to the people of the South at the end of the Revolutionary War and the people of the North who owned slaves, because at that time people owned slaves in almost all of the states. But as I alluded to previously, Massachusetts was the first one that stepped out. Then Delaware stepped out. Some other states said no. I think they were up to five states that had said by 1787 that they were totally outlawing slavery. So when the so here's the question: were the slaves that had that the states had? It's a dumb question. But Massachusetts, which had said that, that slavery is over in the state of Massachusetts, did not the Constitution make it legal again? Because the federal government then became the supreme ruler of the central government. So then it just overrode what the people of that state wanted. I mean, guys, there has to be a correlation here. I don't know how concrete your head has to be to not realize that these people, number one, went to Philadelphia 1787 with a mandate, a strict mandate to only amend the Articles of Confederation. And they totally ignored that. So that made what they did, according to Samuel Bryan, it made their enterprise a criminal conspiracy, because they had planned to do that before they ever went there. So then they go there, and then the first thing they do is, well, not first thing, but they embrace slavery. They codify slavery into the federal government, to the central government for 20 years. And that wasn't in the Articles of Confederation. So the only place you can lay that of making slavery legal in the central government, there had to be the Constitution of 1787. And then, of course, they did away with any oath to Christianity in the states. Well, the states could still have it, but you couldn't send any representatives to the federal government if they had to take that oath. So if you, the senators that the people back then in the 17th Amendment, before the 17th Amendment, the senators that they sent would have been taking the state oath, and that would have been an oath to the Christian faith. And they couldn't have, you know, 22 senators or 26 senators showing up in New York or Philadelphia, wherever the government was at that time, having taken an oath to the Christian faith. They made sure that didn't happen. I am just absolutely astounded that people cannot grasp this. I mean, what else do you have to come up with? And I mean, here is Cattell in a book in 1860, 160-year-old book, that says that it was the North that said, in their shipping industry, said, no, you can't do away with slavery because that's the only thing we're making money on right now. That's the only income revenue source. Well, not totally. You know, they could ship other goods, but they had to take them to other places. But their mainstream at that, and if you will look at the book that was written by three reporters with the Hartford, Connecticut Courant newspaper, three of their investigative journalists wrote a book called Complicity, How the North Promoted, Prolonged, and Profited from the Institution of Slavery. I kind of stole part of that for the name of my show last week. But that, I said the federal government, but they said that, you know, how did it was done? Complicity. And they go into great detail. And in that book, they state that at one time, 90% of the slave trade was centered out of the state of Rhode Island, of the shipping industry. So,
Mike, do you know approximately what year that book was published?
Ten years ago, Dave. It's not that old. It was fairly well done. And what the reason they did that is because they were beginning to find out, like Brown University. Brown University was basically funded by slave traders, and that money went into the creation of Brown University. Aetna Insurance Company, that we've all heard of, Aetna Insurance Company got its founding, got its start by insuring slave shipping. And so these reporters,
wow,
and they went into huge detail about the garment industry or the textile mills in the North that were totally dependent upon the southern growth of cotton for their production, and they couldn't allow their cotton to be taken away. So I'm dumbfounded that people can't wrap their head around this. That, yes, why are you going to tear down my ancestors who owned those slaves? Why are you going to tear down? You want their memory thrown away. You want the flag they fought under and died under. You want that desecrated. You don't want it flown anywhere. But yet, the very government that was established in 1787 embraced slavery. And as we touched on Sunday night, Dave, there have been several Supreme Court decisions which also embrace slavery. So why are people not angry at the central government instead of being angry at the people of the South?
Narrative, Hegelian dialectic, propaganda, controlling information.
Yeah, exactly, and being fed a certain mythology since we were children makes it difficult to accept for a lot of people.
Well, obviously it does, and people just seem to be willing to be led by the nose down this pathway, and if it goes outside of their realm of thinking, if it makes them uncomfortable, then immediately there's name calling, invectives come out. If you say anything about my friend Mike Clifford brought this out, exactly where it was. Vanderbilt University has a course that is an online course, and they have over 800 enrollees in this course, and it's called the Election 2020. And one of the professors put in a question and says, was the U.S. Constitution racist? And immediately, who goes after him but the conservatives? Of course, what else can you say? The Constitution codified slavery into the government. It intertwined it. It made it a part of government. How can you not call that racist? I just become
more and
more
befuddled. You know the difference between Tennessee Tech and Vanderbilt, right?
No, but you're going to tell me.
The graduates from Tennessee Tech are ready to go to work.
Yeah, I can attribute that as true, having lived in Tennessee years ago.
Mike, I have a question.
Question me.
If there had never been a cotton gin, would there have been an Emancipation Proclamation?
I don't think so. I think without the usefulness of slaves, I think approximately 3 million slaves would have never been imported into the United States. And maybe they would have been, like Thomas Sowell said, maybe they would have been hunting lions with a sharp stick. because
what other significant things did Cattell bring? What else did Cattell bring out about the change with the onslaught of the cotton gin?
Well, it was just the how much things became, how much the wealth increased. And as you alluded to earlier, how the worth of a slave increased, what they were worth. And then again, you know, you mentioned that was the fact of the cotton gin making it more productive. And he also brings that into, you know, the steam engine. He brings in several other industrial things that also combined with this, Terry. So it wasn't just the cotton gin. But he brought in several things that were used in textile mills as well that made it much more productive. And, of course, then what it did was because of this, of the cotton gin, it increased the demand for slaves. And so there was no way, even though they said that slavery was going, the importation of slaves was going to end in 1808, there was no way it happened. It was just conveniently forgotten because then it, they were needed because you, suddenly more and more land was coming open to the west. And then as the Mississippi Delta in that area was found to be just absolutely perfect for growing cotton. And, you know, then again, people had to borrow money. And I read about the I did a deep dive into the Wade Hampton family going back several generations a couple of years back. And the Wade Hampton family and Jefferson Davis had huge plantations in Mississippi. And that, you know, and they all owed money on those because the Hampton was from Wade Hampton was from South Carolina, and they started huge plantations for growing cotton. And again, they all of the mortgages that they had taken. And then when, of course, when the war started in 1861, their ability to pay those mortgages was gone. And it caused a real financial crisis. And you know, of course, Jeff Davis lost his plantation.
Let's translate that. There was a tremendous transfer of wealth. There was a tremendous transfer of wealth, just like there is today with this COVID situation. There's a huge transfer of wealth. The banksters are getting richer while everybody else is sucking wind, and that's exactly what happened then. The land was stolen. They had to know that was happening or going to happen when they incited the war.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, a transfer of wealth and a consolidation of assets as well, essentially.
Well, don't forget, gentlemen, that James Solomon Rothschild spent well over a year traveling in 1858 to 1858 to 1860, traveling from the north to the south and going back and forth and sending dispatches back to his uncle in France. So there is that.
Where are you going with that, though, Mike? What does that mean?
Well, let's look at what when Lincoln comes up with the greenback. And I've got that letter. He got the idea from Colonel someone. I can't think of his name right off the top of my head. But he was in 1861. He was wondering, how are we going to finance this war? Because it's not going to be over in 90 days like we thought. And so he is working with his Secretary of the Treasury, Salmon P. Chase, and he's saying, how in the world can we finance this war? Because it's not going to be over. And of course, Stonewall Jackson was kicking their butts up and down the Shenandoah Valley about that time, back and forth. And outnumbered 3-1, and he was still kicking everybody's butt. They became so worried about Stonewall marching right into Washington, D.C., they would actually go up and take the planks off the bridges at nighttime. So there was a huge, how are we going to finance this war? And so then they came up with the idea of the greenback. And so they started issuing this currency. And the greenback was out there. And then what happens is the Bank of England gets their claws into Salmon P. Chase. And England produces what was called the Hazard Circular. And that's where they said, basically, it was just straightforward. Hey, if we allow them to get by with this greenback, we're not going to make a penny. We have to do something to change that. So they got their hooks into Salmon P. Chase and John Sherman. I've got some letters that went back and forth between the Bank of England and a law firm in New York, to where they were talking about how could they get John Sherman into the fold, which was William Tecumseh Sherman's brother. And they got him into, because he was powerful in the Congress at the time. And so they got money into those two, and they came up with the Currency Act of 1862, which outlawed the greenback. So then the only way Lincoln could finance the war was to borrow money through bonds, because when they first went to the Bank of England about loans to finance their war, the banksters in England told them, okay, yeah, we'll be glad to loan you the money. Here, you can have all you want at 30%. And there was no way. Lincoln says there's no way we can do that. So he and Salmon P. Chase go, okay, well, we're just going to produce these greenbacks. But, of course, then Salmon P. Chase is sold out. And the Secretary of the Treasury is mentioned in the Hazard Circular, pardon me, where they say we can't make any money. We can't allow this to continue. We can't do it. So the Currency Acts of 1862 and 1863 basically didn't outlaw the greenback. It just said it couldn't be used to pay a debt. Well, if you can't use money to pay a debt,
Mike, did you say 30% interest?
Yeah.
That's what the banks asked.
That's right.
That's what the banks asked initially.
30%. And at that time, wasn't there any kind of prohibition against usury or things like that or not?
No.
Well, the usury laws were designed to protect the individual, not the government.
Right.
Ah. Okay.
So there was – so they said that, hey, we can't make any money. I wish I had that Hazard Circular in front of me right now. How much time do we have, Terry?
About 8 minutes, 9 minutes. Dave, you asked your question when he was talking about Rothschild's nephew giving reports back, and I wasn't sure whether that was part of why you were asking the question, what does that mean? Because obviously they had to have somebody, and you look at the Rothschild history. And repeatedly, over and over and over again, they would put a representative in play, boots on the ground, in a location, and say to them, okay, you need to make $2 million off of this. You need to increase that by $3 million. And it was like a little contest they had within the family, how much they could rip off during every conflict. And you've heard recently, never let a good crisis go to waste. Well, that's basically what they were doing. They had to have somebody on the ground to foreclose or to take advantage of opportunities or to report back to them where the weak spots were, where they could make their plays to get rich and again, to affect this transfer of wealth.
Right.
I mean, it's like modus operandi over and over and over, the way that they did business. You look at the French Revolution, Napoleon and Waterloo. They did the same thing there. They did the same thing with the Revolutionary War. They did the same thing with Philadelphia, 1787, and they've continued to do it right up until today. And if you could say anything for Trump, he's been the first one that I've ever seen that has prevented them from doing what they wanted to do. And I believe that the fact that they could not get a war is precisely why we have COVID today, because they couldn't create the crisis to take advantage of with a third world war or a war Russia or Syria or wherever. So they've now implemented this pandemic so that they can take advantage of that crisis.
Well, I mm-hmm. think the pandemic was planned because Fauci mentioned it in 17. But, hey, guys, let me run through the hazard circular very quick. I was able to bring it up. And this will tell you, because we had the greenback, the banks were outside the circle, and they couldn't get their 30% interest. So here is what the hazard circular said, and I quote, "Slavery is likely to be abolished by the war power and chattel slavery abolished. This I and my European friends are in favor of, for slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of labor, while the European plan led on by England is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. The great debt that capitalists will see to it is made out of the Civil War be used to control the value of money. To accomplish this, the government bonds must be used as a banking basis. We are now waiting for the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States to make this recommendation. It will not do to allow greenbacks, as they are called, to circulate as money any length of time, as we cannot control that. But we can control the bonds and through them the bank issues." That was published in England in 1862, the Hazard Circular. And so they were worried about the greenback, and they had to do something to change it.
And when that became public, what did they say?
Well, then it was said that it didn't exist, you know, but I've got an 1819 book that a 1919 book that actually has a copy of the Hazard Circular in it. But folks today in colleges will say that it didn't exist at all. But there is also evidence in another book that I think it's called Lincoln Money Massacred or something like that, that was published years ago in the 1930s, that says that offers some pretty good documentation that the Bank of England sent Salmon P. Chase about $500,000 to buy enough members of Congress to get that 1862 and 1863 Currency Acts passed during the war, to ensure that the money...
Well, and Mike, I can see why they would want to sort of disappear the Hazard Circular, because it essentially lays out the modus operandi of the bankers and puts it right out on the table.
Which is the same reason they deny the real existence of the learned protocols of the learned elders of Zion.
Right. And the thing that I was going to get to with this Lincoln Money Massacre or whatever it was, they get this $500,000 into, and it's pretty well documented through some letters that I have that I will be happy to share with you gentlemen should you like to see them. But it was pretty well known that they were shipping money through a law firm in New York to both Salmon P. Chase and also to John Sherman, that they were funneling money in to make sure that they had the votes to do away with the greenback and to institute the bonds. And the debt in 1860 was $97 million. At the end of the Civil War in 1865, the debt was almost $6 billion. Who made out like Clint on that war?
You said $6 billion with a B.
With a B, yes.
Wow.
Mike, what do you want to cover?
Every war, don't they?
Absolutely. Every war is a banker's war.
Well, and, you know, then, guys, we can't overlook Smedley Darlington Butler in War is a Racket, where he just lays it out. Just in no uncertain terms, and that's a very short book. And for all of those people with red, white, and blue fever, old Smedley, old Gimlet Eye, was the only Marine known to have two Congressional Medals of Honor, and was actually put up he was put up four times for the Congressional Medal of Honor, and he earned two. The other two were reduced to Navy stars, I think, something like that, whatever that second award for the Navy people were. But anyway, don't tell me that this guy wasn't patriotic. But old Gimlet Eye laid it out and exactly in War is a Racket, and he said exactly why. And he said, they make the money, the bankers make the money, and we pay with our blood. And yet we still keep
falling. Well, and he basically said, too, that he was essentially a private mercenary for the big corporations like United Fruit Company and other ones. So that really bothered him as well.
Well, and are you also familiar with how he got just absolutely trashed in 1938? He came out and openly criticized Hitler and Mussolini in the press, and he was up for Commandant of the Marine Corps, and he was asked to resign for criticizing Hitler and Mussolini.
No, I didn't know that.
1 minute.
There's even more of that, guys. I'd love to go into that at some time, but the one thing I'd like to thank you, Dave. Thank you for coming on, being with us. You certainly made our presentation better. I thank you for that. And Terry, I can't thank you enough for all the work and all the stuff you do. So appreciate you guys. And at some point in time, let's go into that Smedley Butler thing. Cause that is a deep rabbit hole.
Let's do it. Dave, thanks for being here tonight. Really always enjoy.
Thanks for having me, guys. I really enjoyed it. Thought provoking as usual, Mike.
Well,
we'll be back next
Thursday
night with Handling the Truth with Rebel Madman and Tenacity and Dolphin Dave.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, guys.
Okay.
Were you selling no good sons of a shoe fitting fire starter? Ought to tell you no good premonitory bone frame and nail it to your government walls. All of you, you dadgum government, you sorry rat with ratchets. You got yourself an itch and you're wanting me to scratch it. Well, you dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love it sometimes? Hey, boy. Shoe-fitting fire starters. Ought to tell you no good premonitory bone frame and nail it to your government walls. All of you, you dadgum government, you sorry so-and-so.